His most recent book, The Commentary on Thomas Aquinas' Treatise on Law, was published by Cambridge University Press last year. Now, for all of you who have been dying to know how to pronounce his name, there is a video online at canonwired.com where he has a little conversation with an interviewer and they're talking about the pronunciation of his name. But I will also not leave you hanging. Professor Bujaszewski is the author of 15 books, at least what I counted on your website, perhaps more, yeah, and numerous articles. And although he is adept and erudite in scholarly settings, he also holds the virtue of writing clearly and accessibly for general audiences. And one of his books in particular might be of interest to many of you. It's titled What We Can't Not Know, A Guide, published by Ignatius Press and recently expanded in 2011. It's what he calls a rational defense of the common moral sense of plain people. In this book, he develops this common moral sense into not a proof, but an account of the natural law, that is, the moral knowledge that we have, but we try to suppress. And it also actively engages biblical theology of the natural law. Professor Bujaszewski, although a professor of government, is a devout Roman Catholic, and so is often engaging theological topics, and of course, one of the reasons that he's here today as well. He came to his understanding of natural law in part through his attempt to understand his return to the faith, which he describes as a journey out of nihilism. He has written books for young people, encouraging them to remain faithful against the temptations faced in college and as they enter the adult world. Professor Bujaszewski's professional website, where you can learn more about his education, experience, faith, and writings, is undergroundthomist.org. And I hope with me you are looking forward to his paper, The New Paganism.
Oh, great. Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Well, I am very glad to be here with you. I was smoked out. I was just introduced as a devout Roman Catholic, and that's true. But when I was a Protestant, I was a Catholic-friendly Protestant, and now that I'm a Catholic, I'm a Protestant-friendly Catholic. And I'm really delighted to be here with you. I understand that some of you are theologians, most of you are pastors, and I hope that this talk is going to be helpful to both of you. This is about the new paganism. This is in part a reflection on the experience of the church over the centuries, but it's largely based on just observations about the condition of the culture today, and that includes the pagans that I see around me, I'm sure that you see around you, that I teach at the University of Texas. I don't mean by the new paganism what some people mean. You know, they think that I'm going to talk about Wiccans or about those people who dress up in robes and go to Stonehenge and pretend that they're druids and all of those silly things. Those are, so to speak, card-carrying neo-pagans. But I'm talking about the non-card-carrying sort, the ordinary sort of people who don't necessarily call themselves pagans or neo-pagans, but who are. What I'm thinking about is re-evangelizing. Why do I say re-evangelizing? Aren't we always evangelizing? Well, the world was evangelized for the first time in the first century and in those other early centuries. The job is still, of course, not complete. But the West has already been evangelized and is falling away. Our task now is to re-evangelize. And this time will not be like the first time. This is why the topic of the new paganism is so important. The old evangelism proclaimed the good news among pagan pre-Christian peoples to whom it came as something new. And nothing like that had ever been done before. But nothing like our task has ever been done before either. There they are. There we are casting the net. Re-evangelizing, I think, is not evangelizing as though for the first time again. The very fact of past proclamation makes re-proclamation different because we are proclaiming the gospel to a neo-pagan, a post-Christian people to whom it does not come as new. They've heard it, or at least they think they've heard it before. That's not the same as really having heard it before, but at least they think they have, and that makes a difference. The old world had not yet felt the caress of grace. Our world, once brushed by that caress, now flinches from its touch. Well, how great is the contrast? Is re-evangelization among today's neo-pagans completely and radically different from the original evangelization of the ancient pagans? No. The answer is no. The same Christ is knocking at the door of the same human heart. Natural law was mentioned a few minutes ago. The natural law hasn't changed. Human nature has not changed, despite the fact that it is in a fallen condition. The same Christ knocks at the door of the same human heart, but a heart with a different history. A heart with a different history. Is re-evangelization going to be more difficult? Are these neo-pagans going to be tougher than the old pagans were? Tougher nuts to crack? In some ways, yes. Will they be easier? In some ways, possibly. But whether it's easier or harder, it's going to be different. So let's consider some of the most important differences, and I've tried to reduce them to about 12. Here's the first great difference. The pagan, whenever I say the pagan, I mean the old pagan. When I mean the ones today, I'm going to say neo-pagan. The pagan made excuses for transgressing the moral law. He knew there was a moral law. He made excuses for his sins. By contrast, the neo-pagan pretends when it suits him that there is no morality at all, or perhaps that each one of us has his own morality, or even people will even go so far as to say not just that they have a morality of their own, but that they have a reality of their own. I spoke to a woman once who said each of us has his or her own reality. And I said, you make it sound as though we all lived in different universes instead of sharing the same one. She said, well, we do. Now, this is very shocking. How do you communicate across a gap like that? You know, since the Jews had the law and the prophets, it comes as no surprise that the Jews took morality for granted in the ancient world. But to a great degree, and despite their sordid transgressions, and they were sordid, they were shocking, so did the pagans. Not that skepticism was unknown among them. Forms of skepticism were certainly known among them, but it was a different skepticism than today's skepticism. What is truth? Pilate asked. And it was an interesting question. It wasn't the sort of question that you ask because you want to know the answer. It's the kind of question that you ask because you don't want to know the answer, because he then turned on his heel and walked out of the room. That's skepticism. Yet consider all of the pagan errors to which Paul alludes in his epistles. Was relativism one of them? No. But if he had been writing it today, he could not have omitted it, and I don't believe that he would have. Pagan skepticism doubted whether there were any answers. Neo-pagan skepticism thinks that there are lots of answers. There's a surplus of answers. You can take your pick, because every answer is equally good. The second great difference, which is related to that first great difference, is that the pagan wanted to be forgiven, but he didn't know how to find absolution. To him, the gospel came as a message of release. Not just Jews, but even sometimes Greeks would come to the apostles, would come to Jesus and say, how can we be saved? The idea of being saved was not something that seemed inconceivable to them. But the neo-pagan does not want to hear that he needs to be forgiven, and so to him, the gospel comes not as a message of release, but as a message of a reshackling, of burden, of guilt. This inversion seems incredible because the neo-pagan still has what St. Paul described as the law written on his heart. He certainly does feel the weight of his sins. But he thinks the way to have peace is not to have the weight lifted, but to learn not to take that weight seriously. Hearing Christ's promise of forgiveness, he thinks all those guilty Christians, having chosen to view the freest people in the world, that is Christians, as the most burdened, he naturally views the most burdened, that means people like himself, as the freest. Everyone's done things he regrets. Have you ever heard this line? Everyone's done things he regrets. Everyone lies. Get over it. This is fundamentally different than the situation, I think, that the first missionaries faced. Excuse me there for switching glasses. You know, it was even worse this morning. I was trying to drive in the rain at 4 o'clock in the dark to the airport, and I thought, why can't I see anything? Darn these Texas roads, they don't have reflective paint on them, and then I realized I was wearing the wrong glasses. That was a large part of the problem. So at least I can see my notes now, although I probably still can't drive. The pagan was also raised differently. He was brought up in the ways and in the atmosphere of paganism. And in order to be converted, he had to be removed from both of those, from the ways of paganism and from the atmosphere of paganism. By contrast, although the neo-pagan has probably also been taught pagan ways, he may have been brought up in an atmosphere of Christian sentiment. Consequently, he regards there's an example of it, you know, Santa Claus and all that jazz. Consequently, he regards the gospel not as the story of true God become true man, but as a sentimental fable for children. Santa Claus sets the tone of the gospel for him. Even Christian sentiments are difficult to take seriously apart from the actual life of grace that makes them more than sentiment, that actually attaches them to the channels through which the Holy Spirit can actually pump life into us. The fourth great difference. You know, the pagan was likely to be exposed to the gospel either all at once or not at all. Either he never heard the missionaries or he got a good dose of it. The neo-pagan, on the other hand, has been exposed to just enough spores to develop an allergic reaction. He's got just enough to have developed an immune response. Perhaps he was baptized as a child, but never seriously taught the faith. Perhaps he was dropped off at church now and then, but his parents didn't stay, and then they just come and pick him up later. Perhaps everything that he knows about the faith, or thinks that he knows about the faith, is from watching how the Grinch Stole Christmas when he was a child, or attending a few weddings and funerals after he grew up. This is not the same sort of situation at all, because it also means that unlike the ancient pagan, the neo-pagan has a lot of unlearning to do. Now, it's true, of course, that there were canards. There were false characterizations of what Christians did. You know, that they did terrible things, had orgies at their love feasts and so forth. People said terrible things about them. And the ancient pagan did have to learn that those things weren't true. But as to Christian doctrine, even as to the fundamentals of what it is to be a Christian, who Jesus Christ was, what he taught, these are things that the modern neo-pagan has usually got wrong and needs to unlearn. Now, I mentioned that the pagan suffered the burden of a pagan childhood, but he was also spared the burden of an interrupted Christian childhood, and that has to do with more than just these sentimental problems that we were just talking about. Whereas the pagan had never been immersed in the waters of faith at all, too often the neo-pagan has been dipped in and then pulled out. Maybe he was taken to Bible school on Sunday when he was small, he went to catechism classes, but then it was all over. The family didn't practice the faith. I know a young man whose parents were regular churchgoers, and it was time for confirmation for him, and then they got angry with the church about something or other. They stopped going, and his Christian formation was never completed. He was so relieved. He was so glad in adulthood, in his late 30s, when he had the opportunity to actually learn what the faith was all about. But in the meantime, he'd experimented all over. You know, he'd tried Buddhism and all sorts of things. This is so common. The family stops practicing the faith. It seems to be something the children do, but grown-ups don't. Or the parents got divorced and neither one took the child anymore, and he was left high and dry. The sixth great difference is this. Not only was the pagan devoid of nostalgia for a Christian past — there was no Christian past, the past was a pagan past — but he was also unencumbered by the anger of guilt for rejecting that Christian past. And people often do feel a mix of emotions here. They feel guilty about what they reject, but they still are angry. And in fact, the guilt makes them angrier. The neo-pagan, therefore, is susceptible to both the nostalgia and the anger at the same time. He might feel sort of all warm and fuzzy when he hears the Christmas carols, But he may at the same time be angry and feel both of these things at once. I once met an atheist with a chip on his shoulder. This was at a conference, a much smaller conference than this one. It was a sort of a round table scholarly conference. There were perhaps only 30 people there. It began with an opening banquet. It concluded with a closing banquet. And there were a lot of intense conversations in between for a couple of days. Well, I sat with him at both the opening banquet and the closing banquet just by coincidence. And when he found out that I was a believer, he just couldn't resist. He announced to me that he was an atheist. He goes on about Darwin for a long time and how ridiculous Christianity is. And he boasted of the fun, his words, the fun that he had, I quote, ruining all the Catholic kids at the Catholic college where he taught. Wrong fellow to have hired. Yet, the same man, at the closing banquet, after a few glasses of wine — maybe that's what made the difference. You know, they sometimes say in vino veritas, in wine is truth. And he'd had a few glasses of wine, and I won't say that he was tipsy, but he did get a little rosy. And he said that he was very religious. He said he was a very spiritual person. And that he didn't believe in God, mind you. He had recently joined a church choir from sheer love of the great old hymns. And he spent quite a while criticizing modern churches for singing all this newfangled stuff instead of those. He says, "Rise up, you men of God," and he's talking about all this. I thought, is this the same man? By turns, he was nostalgic for something good that he had left behind, and belligerent because he really knew that he had had no good reason for having left it. The seventh great difference is this, you know, because the gospel was new to him. The pagan — do you like these transition effects, by the way? It makes it look like even a bad talk is a good talk, and so you can... Because the gospel was new to the ancient pagan, the pagan needed to learn it from the beginning. The neo-pagan's in a very different position. He needs — I touched on this before, but let's dwell on it. He needs to unlearn things that he's learned about the gospel that happen to be untrue. We see a trivial symptom of the problem, as I illustrate here, in the great number of people who think that there was a little drummer boy who accompanied the shepherds. A notion which makes the Christmas narrative seem most implausible to anyone more than 10 years of age. But non-existent drummer boys are the least of the problems. The neo-pagan is likely to have entirely mistaken views of what Christianity teaches about creation, about the fall, about redemption. He probably doesn't even know that there are three eras of salvation history, and about the relationship between God and man. Now, the eighth difference might be puzzling at first, because it at first may seem to be about something that isn't a difference. This thing seems to be unchanged, but even here there really is a difference. Today, just as in ancient times, the non-believer hails Caesar, not Christ, as Lord. In other words, he believes in this world and its promises and not the next. But whereas the pagan reproached Christians for doubting distinctively ancient delusions, for example, the eternal destiny of the Empire of Rome, the neo-pagan is more likely to reproach Christians for doubting distinctively modern illusions, for example, the idea that by technology and social engineering, we can devise a world in which nobody needs to be good. Now, in one way, I've been speaking about delusions, just now I did, but we have to be honest. In one way, the pagan was less deluded than the neo-pagan, because he could hardly fail to know that he was an idolater. The neo-pagan's an idolater too, but he's much less likely to know it. Why is that? Because he doesn't recognize his own idols. The ancient pagan's idols were visible. They were touchable. They were carved from physical substances like wood and, in this case, stone. But if faith concerns things not seen, then in a certain odd sense, the neo-pagan is, you know, perhaps more faithful, because the neo-pagan today certainly believes in things not seen. His idols are all invisible and untouchable. They're woven of sensations and wishes and ideas like pleasure and success and the future. Even his magazines have names like self, which is, of course, invisible. The body is only its emblem. Perhaps visible idols were always masks for invisible idols, but in our day the masks have come off, and this confuses people about the status of their own paganism. The tenth great difference is that the pagan world was unfamiliar with Christian ideas, but by contrast, the neo-pagan world, our world today, is brimming with Christian ideas. But there are Christian ideas that have been de-Christianized. The makers of this world, the neo-pagan world, the marketers, the publicists, the artists, the politicians, the intellectuals, the rulers of the fashion industry, the entertainers, have even appropriated some of them. But they've emptied them of Christian meaning. Do you know, I don't know if you can actually read what it says on her back. I was so proud of having come up with that image on the in my searching to illustrate it. But that elaborate tattoo on the back of the young woman says faith, hope, love, eternity. I think it says peace there somewhere. You know, it's all these Christian ideals that obviously, by being used as a sort of a sexual come-on, have been de-Christianized. The neo-pagan often has a high view of what he or she calls faith, hope, and love, whether or not they tattoo themselves with it. It's more likely that the neo-pagan is going to tattoo a skull on himself or something like that. Faith, hope, and love were virtues that were undreamt of among the pagans. Yet, the neo-pagan today is likely to use the term faith for clinging to the illusions of a barren life. That's what he calls having faith. He's likely to use hope as a synonym for mere worldly optimism. Oh yeah, things will work out. That's hope. And he's likely to use love for desire or sentiment without sacrifice or commitment of the will to the true good of the other person. Another example of such emptying is the way that some neo-pagans accept the Christian view that history has meaning and direction. Well, we certainly think that it does. The Bible is mostly not a treatise. Most of it is history. The history of salvation. The story of what God did to rescue us from what we had done to ourselves by alienating ourselves from Him. History has meaning and direction, and this God came among us, and He is going to come again. But the neo-pagan clings to the idea that some neo-pagans don't. Some postmodernists say history has no story, but some will cling to the idea of progress. History has meaning. The meaning is things are just going to get better and better, but God has nothing to do with it. It's a blind tale of progress toward what? Toward whatever they want the world to have more of. You know, faster airplanes, a higher gross national product, better virtual reality. Pagans didn't believe in progress. Pagans, this is something that that the whole notion would have been inconceivable had it not been for St. Augustine's philosophy of history. Pagans believed in endlessly repeated recurrence. In other words, the same darn thing over and over and over, although perhaps in very, very long looping cycles. Nor must we overlook another profound divergence between the old non-believers and the new non-believers. If the pagan was at all inclined to admit that his nation had ever done wrong, which he usually wasn't, well, still, he had no one else to blame. He'd done it, but the neo-pagan can blame his culture's sins on Christianity, right? And this isn't this what in fact happens? We're being reproached even still today for the trial of Galileo, for the plunder of the American indigenes, for the Spanish Inquisition. They were all the Christians' fault, the neo-pagan says. And, you know, he's got a point. Surely Christians were involved in these things, and surely these things were gravely evil. Although, if the neo-pagans were consistent, they would set the thousands killed by Christian inquisitions against the millions killed by atheistic inquisitions in the 20th century. You see why they don't do that, don't you? Christian offenses are easier to invoke just because the church admits them. And they're also more scandalous just because of the gospel of love. So that Christians make good targets because they feel bad about those things. You know, one of my first books, gosh, this was way back in the 1980s. I was just this scholar. I'd only recently, a young guy, I didn't have tenure yet. I'd only recently returned to Christian faith after years as an atheist and more than an atheist. I didn't even believe that there was a rationally discernible difference between good and evil, or that we were personally responsible for our actions in those days. I'd only recently returned from the wilderness by the grace of God. And I submitted a book manuscript. And, the way this works is the press, if it is interested at all, it'll send it out to reviewers. And the first review was pretty good. The second review was pretty good. So I'm waiting on that third one. Third one comes in. Press sends it to me. I read the first page. Well, he's full of praise. I think I'm in. He says, oh, this book is really interesting. It's made me re-examine all of my most deeply held beliefs. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. But then halfway down page two, he says, but it should not be published. Why? He said, because in chapter 4, the author mentions God. And God does not belong in political philosophy. And he then talked about the massacre of the Huguenots, for which he blamed me. So I decided to, you know, to deal with that by facing the tiger. So I rewrote the preface, and I recounted the incident itself, and said an earlier reader of this manuscript said this, and I said, I raise you your, I see your 1,000 Frenchmen, and I raise you 1,000,000 Chinese. Still, you know, I guess that perhaps might seem glib. Maybe it worked, right? I got the book published. But it's hard for people to see this. It's hard for people to see this. And it's because paradoxically, although they don't realize it, they're judging the sins of Christians by a much higher standard, because it's residually still has elements of the Christian standard, than a much higher standard than the pagans had ever used before. The same people who will then turn around and say, well, you have your morality and I have mine, and there is no true morality. Okay? Don't ask for consistency here. You would think that this 11th grade difference wouldn't exist, right? You would expect the memory of the good influence of the gospel on the world to favor its reproclamation. Things have happened since the advent of Christianity in the world. Things have happened since the spread of the gospel through the world that had never happened before in all of those centuries of paganism. It took a long time to do it, but in those parts of the world that were within the biblical orbit, we eventually got rid of slavery, for instance. The status of women increased immeasurably. The status of children who were more or less used, you know, in Rome, if you didn't want your child, you could just expose the infant. You would put him in a jar out on the street, and perhaps the people who ran professional begging companies would pick him up, break his legs at the thighs so that he'd be crippled, and raise him to be a professional beggar, or else he would just die. Christianity has made a difference. So you would expect that people would remember this, and that this would favor the reproclamation of Christianity. After all, the pagan world had never experienced the revivifying effect of grace. The neo-pagan world has. Consider other things. Consider the gospel's high view of conscience, which is under such assault today, as we know, by the state, and of the dignity of the human person and how these have transformed Western culture. Surely all of that can't be overlooked, you think. Well, sure, it can be overlooked. The problem is that the neo-pagan who has never learned history honestly and does not remember more than 15 minutes of it anyway, takes for granted all of the good that his culture has inherited from Christendom. In his view, things simply got better. That's just what happens. Or at least, if it isn't how history goes, it's at least how history went. Lucky thing. If he assigns anything the credit for these goods, he assigns it not to grace, but to such things as science, capitalism, and enlightenment. To put it another way, he expects the stream to keep on flowing without the spring. And when the spring does begin to dry up, he may be vaguely uneasy, but he doesn't fully grasp what he's saying. Why doesn't he? Because his, if I may put it this way, his ideas of dry and wet are also changing. It's not just that the neo-pagan world around him is losing respect for the sacredness of conscience, for instance, and the dignity of the human person, all those things brought in by Christianity. He is a part of that world, and he's losing respect for them, too. So he may be vaguely uncomfortable, but he can't quite diagnose the difficulty. These things seem so unimportant to him. Why do those crazy Christians obsess over them? Now, some of you may be puzzled. You know, there's a laugh, of course, when I said that people don't remember more than 15 minutes of history today, but you may have been puzzled by what I said just before that, that people have not learned history honestly today. I should perhaps explain that. This is another anecdote. When I was an assistant professor, wasn't making very much money and, you know, trying to think about how to keep bread on the table, I had an opportunity to, I was approached by a textbook publishing company, one of the national publishers, that said, we've got this ninth grade civics textbook, and we'd like to beef it up to an 11th grade textbook that could be used either for civics or for political science. Would you rewrite it for us? And I said, yeah, sure. They don't pay me at the university, so okay. Well, you know, they have objectives. They say, you have to put this in it, you have to put this in it, you have to put this in it. Gleaned from studying the major markets, Texas, Florida, the other places that buy a lot of textbooks, And I looked at the list of objectives. They all seemed reasonable things to add. They wanted me to, for instance, to explain the language of the Declaration of Independence in such a way that students could understand it. They wanted me to explain the influences on Martin Luther King when he developed his doctrine of nonviolent civil disobedience during the civil rights era. And I said, well, sure, I'll add all these things. So I did. Well, then I was contacted by my editor after I turned in the manuscript. He was upset by the discussion of what was in the Declaration of Independence because it says the Creator had endowed us with these inalienable rights. That's what the language says. And I said, well, that's God. And I explained what Creator means, and I explained all of that. He says, you can't say God. I said, it says right here, explain the language of the Declaration of Independence. He says, I don't care, you can't say God. I said, but that's what it means. He said, can't you say good or something? Yeah, we were endowed by good with these inalienable rights. When it came to Martin Luther King, I had said that he was influenced by Jesus, yeah, all right, and also by Mohandas Gandhi in developing his philosophy of nonviolence. And he was very upset. I could mention Gandhi, but I couldn't mention Jesus. All right? This illustrates the way that our young people are taught history now. So this is another difficulty. Finally, the 12th, the last great difference, the pagan knew that he was not a Christian. By contrast, a certain kind of neo-pagan may think that he is a Christian. He may even go to church. We've got a lot of them. Most of you are pastors. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? This oddity is perhaps the most challenging difference between evangelization and re-evangelization. In the ancient world, the people who needed to be evangelized were outside of the walls of the church. Today, they include thousands upon thousands who are inside the walls, but who think just like those who are outside the walls. When the gospel is proclaimed, they complain. I think the world is a difficult mission field, but the pew is a hard one too. It's hard for the shepherds to bring home the lost sheep if they think they're already in the fold. What is the greatest obstacle then to reaching the neo-pagan? Whether the one in the pew or the one outside the walls, I believe that the greatest obstacle lies in the condition of Christendom itself. We are divided. Christ's body is torn. We speak of the body of Christ, we act as though we believe that, and yet we think that we can rip off arms and leave the torso over here. I'm not trying to be crude. It may also seem that I'm trying to change the subject. We've been discussing how to advance the cause of the gospel among neo-pagans, not the cause of Christian unity among Christians. Isn't the end of the lecture a rather bad time to change the subject? If you were going to change the subject and cheat on what you were asked to talk about, shouldn't you at least have the courtesy to do that at the beginning? Well, I'm not changing the subject because the two causes are joined. And I hope you will agree with me. To suppose that we can reach neo-pagans with the Word of God without unity in the Word of God is arrogant folly. And you don't have to take it from me. Christ's last plea to his Father at his Last Supper with the disciples was that they may become perfectly one. And the reason that he gave is all about our theme today. So that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Think about that. The world we have to become perfectly one. He could have given a lot of true good reasons for that. But the one that he mentioned is so that the world may know, looking at our unity of love, that you have sent me and has loved them even as you have loved me. The lesson is plain. If we are not one in proclaiming Christ, the world will not recognize him. If we are not one in proclaiming the gospel, the neo-pagan world will find the gospel very hard even to hear it all. Thank you very much.